So all week long, you have been out there in life with all of its stress, all of the demands on your time. You've been around people all week. People can be difficult. Maybe you've even experienced a little conflict with some people during the course of this week, month, year, life. But you're here now in this sanctuary. And I want to invite you to take a deep breath. And if you're comfortable, close your eyes for just a second and let's do a brief guided meditation. Picture yourself sitting right next to a beautiful mountain stream. The sun is warm on your shoulders. Birds are singing. A gentle breeze caresses your cheeks. At a distance upstream, you can hear the rhythmic, soothing babble of a small waterfall. This is your secret place. No one knows you're here. No one can bother you here. And as you look down into the crystal clear water, you can clearly make out the face of the person whose head you're holding underwater. There. Now, do you feel better?
Sorry.
Didn't see that coming, right? But isn't that the way life is, right? We want to be calm. We want to find some peace. We listen to some music or we try to go to sleep. But that person that we're in conflict with, it's like their face haunts us wherever we go, disrupting our serenity. A 50-year-old Ohio man going through something of a midlife crisis went out and bought himself a brand new Porsche sports coupe convertible. As he drove it off the dealership lot, out onto the street, up onto the superhighway, man, that Porsche wanted to go. And so he went with the feeling. He accelerated 90 miles an hour, what little hair he had left, blowing in the wind. It was an exhilarating experience until he hears the sound of a siren behind him, looks in the rearview mirror, and here comes an Ohio State trooper. Impulsively, instinctively, the guy thinks to himself, you know, I'm in a Porsche. I can outrun any old cop car. And so he puts the pedal to the metal, 100 miles an hour, 110 miles an hour, 120 miles an hour. And then suddenly he comes to his senses and says, wait a minute, I'm 50 years old. I could spend the rest of my life in jail. He pulls over, slows down, stops. Let's just say the state trooper, when he walks up to the Porsche, is not amused. What were you thinking, man? You're crazy. But, the trooper said, this is your lucky day. I'm just about to get off shift, and the last thing I want to do is to write and process another ticket, so I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you can give me a really good excuse for what you just did, something I've never heard before, I'm going to let you go. The man thinks to himself for a second. He says, well, officer, it's like this. 3 years ago, my wife ran off with an Ohio State trooper, and I was afraid you were him bringing her back to me. Who's that person in your life that you want to run as far as you can get away from? That person that you would just assume, at least in your fantasies, hold their head underwater. To be around people is to experience human conflict. And human conflict stirs us up. Last week, we began a mini sermon series, 3 weeks here in the month of November, entitled, How to Keep Your Sanity in a Mad, Mad World. Last week, we talked about the stressful demands of time and schedule and how practicing the Sabbath principle can help us find some balance in life. But it's not just time demands that stress us out. People stress us out. Conflict stresses us out. And that's what we're going to talk about today. As followers of Jesus, as people of faith, how are we supposed to deal with human conflict? Let's start with prayer. Jesus, if we'd been alive when you were here on earth, we can picture ourselves sitting down at your feet and listening to your words. Your words are life, the way, the truth, and the life. You're not literally, physically in this place today, but your word is with us. We have the Gospels, and we want to sit at your feet today and learn something so that we can live it, so that we can be faithful followers, and so that our lives are beautiful. Teach us today, Jesus. Open our hearts to your word. We ask in the name, your holy name. Amen. When I was a kid, my dad's best friend was his brother, my Uncle Tom. And my mom's best friend was Uncle Tom's wife, my Aunt Jean. And their two kids, one of them, Tommy, was my best friend, my cousin, and Joannie was my little sister's best friend. So almost every weekend, they would come over to our house or we would go over to their house. We had so much fun together. We'd sit around the fire pit in the backyard making s'mores and roasting hot dogs, and we'd talk to the wee hours of the morning, looking up at the starry, starry sky, and sometimes we would play flashlight hide and seek after dark, you know, where you gotta shine your light on the person that you find, and man, Uncle Tom could find the best hiding places. One time, he climbed up a mid-sized tree, and we looked and we looked and we couldn't find him until he finally started hooting like an owl, and then we figured out where he was. It was the best hiding place ever. One time when Tom and Jean and their kids were out at our house, Uncle Tom, Dad, me, and Tommy were playing a pickup basketball game in the driveway. We did that often, and when we did that, always Dad would guard Uncle Tom and I would guard Tommy. It was me and Dad against Uncle Tom and Tommy. But this time we decided to change it up and do something a little bit different. So Dad guarded Tommy and Uncle Tom guarded me. Now Tommy was a spitfire. He could be a little bit aggressive and annoying. And he decided to get physical, get aggressive with Dad playing basketball. You know, throwing some elbows, pushing a little bit, even though he was tiny compared to Dad. And Dad started to get a little bit aggravated. You know, this punk trying to push him around and so forth. And Dad was never one to sort of back off from a little bit of a confrontation. He was going to teach Tommy a little bit of a lesson. So Dad started getting physical with Tommy, even though he was much bigger. Before long, Uncle Tom said, "Brother," they always called each other brother, kind of annoying, but "brother," he said, "lighten up." But Tommy kept it up, so Dad kept it up. Several times, Uncle Tom said, "Brother, you're going to hurt him. Brother, stop it. Come on, it's just a game." Tommy kept it up. Dad kept it up. Until at one point, Uncle Tom just stopped, threw the basketball out in the yard and said, "That's it. We're done. We're out of here. Tommy, get in the car." Dad says, "Come on, brother." "Tommy, get in the car. We're going home." "Gene," calling to his wife out in the backyard, talking to Mom. "Come on, we're going home." Gene comes around the corner. "What's going on?" "I'll tell you in the car. Get in." They get in the car and they peel out of the driveway. And I'm standing there thinking, what just happened here? And that was it. End of relationship. Forget the weekends with Uncle Tom and Aunt Jean and their kids. It was over. Dad lost his best friend. Neither of them would pick up the phone and call each other. It was over. Mom lost her best friend. I lost my best friend. My little sister lost her best friend. And that was the first time in my young life that I vividly experienced the power of human conflict to disrupt and sow chaos in our lives. A couple years later, Something happened in our neighborhood. We lived way out in the country near Acton, Indiana, on a country road, and there were four houses that dotted the roadway in our little neighborhood. We were all on large acre lots because when you live in the country, you want the wide open spaces, right? We had wonderful neighbors. Everybody knew everybody, all for one, one for all. It was a great place to grow up. But then, some city slickers, the Nelsons, bought the vacant lot between our house and our nearest neighbor and proposed to build a house that was so big on this lot that they would need a zoning variance because one side of the house would come within 15 feet of our neighbor's house, and on the other side of the house, on our property line, they wanted to put in this big blacktop driveway. I mean, we lived in the country. Nobody needed blacktop driveways. They wanted to put in this big blacktop driveway that, because of the slope of the ground, would have to sit this high off the ground right on our property line so that he could have, Ed Nelson, a side-loading garage for his big old 98. We were absolutely outraged. This is the country. We moved out here for wide open spaces, and these city slickers come in here, and they're just going to jam the place up. They got their zoning variance. Dad said they probably paid off the zoning commission. To make matters worse, to prepare for construction, Ed Nelson decided that rather than hiring professionals to clear out the old growth trees where they were going to build their big house, he and a buddy could do it with a chainsaw. So one Saturday morning they show up and we're watching from one of the bedroom windows as they're preparing to cut down this 60-foot tree. My mom said, he has no idea what he's doing. They started up, the tree fell, and it landed right on our neighbor's roof. The roof exploded in splintered wood, and the tree almost killed one of our neighbor's kids who was sleeping in bed at the time. Let's just say when the Nelsons finally moved into their house, they were persona non grata in our neighborhood. These were outsiders. How dare they disrupt the peace, the harmony, the spaciousness of our neighborhood? And once they moved in, if they were in the backyard and we were in the backyard, we did not see them. And vice versa. It's as if they did not exist. You can't come into our neighborhood and act like that and expect us to welcome you. In fact, Dad was so upset, he took three big metal stakes and drove them in the ground right by our property line, right where Ed backed his big old 98 out of the garage. And it was so tight that he would have to back up the tires to the edge of the driveway with his big trunk hanging out over our property. So Dad put those metal stakes there so that now Ed would have to back up, pull forward, and wedge his way out of the garage. Me and my sisters would sit and watch out of the window and laugh. It was so funny. He was getting what he deserved. As Bugs Bunny would say, I guess you know this means war. And suddenly, this neighborhood that had been so peaceful and beautiful and harmonious was turned into a zone of hostility. Graphic example number two in my young life of the power of human conflict to destroy and disrupt and sow chaos in our lives. Conflict is inevitable because where there are people, there will be conflict. But as followers of Jesus, when we experience conflict in our life, what are we supposed to do? Who is it that you're at odds with in your life right now that God is calling to your mind? What are we supposed to do about that? Well, Jesus has some advice for us. You heard Duana share the gospel reading a few moments ago, a passage that comes from Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said, Matthew 5:21, you've heard that it was said to those of ancient times, thou shalt not commit murder. Actually, it was Moses who said that, and this is one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. There were lots of good religious people in Jesus' culture who took great pride in the fact that they kept the Ten Commandments religiously. They were proud of the fact that they had never murdered anybody. But Jesus says, okay, that's a start, but let's take it deeper. Let's just don't leave it at the minimal religious level. Let's ask what it means to respond with deep spirituality to the conflicts in our life. So Jesus says, you've heard that it was said to those of ancient times, thou shalt not commit murder. But I, Jesus, say to you that if you are so much as angry with a brother or a sister, you'll be liable to judgment. And if you say, raka, to a brother or sister, you'll be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you'll be liable to the hell of fire. In other words, Jesus is saying, it's not good enough just to not murder somebody. It's not good enough just to not hold their head underwater. Jesus says, I want you to take it deeper. I don't even want you to be angry. And I don't want you to lash out with words against them directly or in the presence of others. When you said raka in Jesus' culture, it was a deep insult. Raka comes from the root word that means to spit on someone. So when you said raka to somebody, it was like, I spit on you. And these words, you fool, it's kind of a euphemistic English translation of the Greek term moraz, which meant an utterly wicked, reprobate person. So when you said raka and moraz to somebody, it would be like in our language today, you saying F you to somebody, you worthless piece of blank. Not that any of us would ever say such a thing. Or at least most of us would not say that thing. But God knows there are times when we've all wanted to say it. We've wanted to find the most hurtful, wounding, aggressive words we could use because they have hurt us, they have betrayed us, they have let us down, and they deserve it. But Jesus says, don't do it. Why, Jesus? They deserve it. Why shouldn't we do it? He tells us why we shouldn't do it. Because when we lash out at them, when we nurture anger and grudges within us, Jesus says, we become liable to the hell of fire. Let's unpack what that means. Because it probably doesn't mean what you think. Or maybe I should say, it means a whole lot more than you think it does. There are layers and textures to what Jesus is saying here. The New Testament Greek word that is translated there, hell of fire, is the word Gehenna. Gehenna was the word that was commonly used in the ancient Greek language, which was the primary spoken language of commerce throughout the Roman Empire, including throughout Israel. The Greek word Gehenna in the New Testament was the word used to refer to that bad place that bad people go in the afterlife. That word Gehenna was actually derived from an actual physical location on the face of the earth in Israel near Jerusalem, a place called the Valley of Hinnom. The Valley of Hinnom, transliterated into Greek, became Gehenna. The Valley of Hinnom is a beautiful mountain valley located right outside of Jerusalem. Here's a picture of what it looks like today. But in Old Testament times, it became a center for occult worship, where people would worship foreign gods. And as part of those rituals, parents would bring children and sacrifice them as burnt offerings to the gods. So to faithful Israelites, the Valley of Hinnom was a cursed, doomed, desperate place. So that even after that kind of heinous worship was no longer customary, nobody wanted to go to the Valley of Hinnom. Nobody wanted to live in the Valley of Hinnom. So that by the time of Jesus, the Valley of Hinnom had been turned into a garbage dump. People from Jerusalem would carry their garbage out to the Valley of Hinnom. dump it and light it on fire, so that the Valley of Hinnom was a place of perpetual fire, smoke, stench, decay, a place where insects and worms never died. Recognize the New Testament language. So it's as if when ancient people were trying to think of what should we call that place in the afterlife where some people go, the bad place, they said, it's like their thoughts were, what's the worst place we've ever experienced on the face of the earth? Oh, the Valley of Hinnom. And that, were, that place gave its name to this afterlife place. The reason I tell you that is because for Jesus' contemporaries, as they heard him speak, they wouldn't, as he spoke these words, have just been thinking about that place some people go in the afterlife. Because to them, the Valley of Hinnom was also very real. They'd all seen it. They'd all experienced it. And so they would have understood that Jesus wasn't just referring to what anger can, the harm anger can cause us in the life to come. But he was referring also to the very real fact that that anger could make our lives in the here and now a living hell, a Valley of Hinnom, a place of fire. Because you know what it feels like when you're really angry with someone, right? It feels like there's a fire burning inside of ourselves. So that what Jesus was literally saying to us, warning us about, is that when we nurse anger and grudges within us, it's like we're lighting ourselves on fire. Who would ever want to do that? What Jesus is trying to say to us today is this anger that you're feeling, it's not about your enemy. Yeah, they may deserve it, but Jesus says, I'm talking to you and your life, and this is about you and your quality of life. This is about you and your sanity and your serenity. This is about the peaceful valley that was meant to be your soul and not turning it into a living hellscape. A fourth grade school teacher gives her kids an assignment. She says, tomorrow we're going to do a little experiment. So I want all of you to bring from home a clear plastic bag and a sack of potatoes. So the kids bring this stuff in. The next day, sit down in class. The teacher says, now before we do this experiment, I want each of you to take out a piece of paper, and I want you to write down on the paper the names of all the people who have hurt you, people that you're angry with, people who have betrayed you. So the kids started writing down names. Some of them were really getting into a long list. Okay, now the teacher says, I want you to cut out each of those names and tape a different name to one of your potatoes, and then the next potato, and then put all of those potatoes of yours into your plastic bag. Seal it up. Okay, the teacher said, here's the experiment, here's your assignment. When you go home today, you take this bag with you. When you lay down to sleep tonight, you put the bag next to your bed. When you get up in the morning, you take it to breakfast with you. When your parents drive you to school the next morning, put it on the seat next to you. When you come into class tomorrow, bring it with you. When you go out to recess, you got to carry the bag with you. Before long, these heavy bags started to become a real burden, a real drag on their lives. Not just that, but before long, the potatoes began to go bad. Moldy, smelly, slimy, and sprout eyes. At which point the teacher says, okay, you can stop now. But she says, I never want you to forget this experiment. Because when you are angry and carry anger and a grudge with you, this is what happens. It's a heavy load to bear. And guess what? Medical science documents that. Controlled experiments have documented that when people carry anger inside them, there is a statistically measurable increase in the incidence of insomnia, headaches, digestive issues, anxiety, depression, high blood pressure, heart attacks, strokes. So that what we're talking about, what Jesus is talking to us about today, it's not just about our soul. It's about body, mind, and soul, and the havoc that anger can reap on us holistically. Okay, Jesus, but anger is inevitable. So when it arises, what do you want us to do with it? In today's passage, he offers us three practical steps we can take to deal in a healthy way with legitimate anger. The first of those three steps we've already talked about, Jesus says, don't lash out and talk bad to or about the person you're angry with. But yeah, what's next? Jesus tells us in verses 23 through 26, he says, when you're offering your gift to God at the altar, when you're worshiping, if you happen to remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. Don't wait. First, he says, be reconciled to your brother and sister. Then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser, or you'll be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you'll never get out of there until you've paid the very last penny. When we nurse grudges and indulge in anger, that anger literally imprisons us, body, mind, and soul, and it won't let us go until we pay the last penny. So, Jesus says, when you're angry with somebody, resist the urge to lash out against them using bad words against them or about them, number one. But number two, in this passage, Jesus tells us, don't sit on your anger. Seek to resolve it quickly. If you're in the middle of worship and you remember it, he says, go, don't wait. Jesus says, do it quickly or it'll end up imprisoning you, okay? What is it we're supposed to do quickly, Jesus? That's the third step. He says, go to the person you're in conflict with and seek reconciliation. The New Testament Greek word for reconciliation is dialasso, which means to renew a friendship by mutual concession. Think about what those words mean. To renew a friendship, how? By mutual concession. Rick Renner elaborates on what this Greek term means. He says, the idea is giving up an argument, surrendering a point, conceding to someone else, or letting something go and refusing to let it be an issue. In other words, even though the issue is not totally agreed upon, you have at least agreed to be right with each other going forward. There's so much wisdom in that. The point is not that we're going to be able to reconcile with every person we're in conflict with. The point is, we should do everything in our power to make that possible if they're willing to engage the process. The Bible says, in so much as is in you, live peaceably with all people. In so much as is in you, the other person won't make peace, there's a problem, right? But Jesus says we should be proactive and ready to seek reconciliation. And reconciliation doesn't mean that I sit down with you, I tell you exactly what you've done wrong, and you say, yes, you're right about everything, I was wrong, and it's all on my terms. The word, the concept Jesus is using here calls for mutual concession. Because, look, it's good when we experience conflict for us to sit down and unpack what has happened. It's good for me to hear your perspective on what happened. It's good for me to hear you to hear my perspective on what happened, because we're all acting out of our own background, experience, personalities, and proclivities. But almost 99% of the time when we do that, we're not going to reach complete agreement on who did what wrong and when. But Jesus says, don't let that stand in the way. Once you've done your best to unpack the baggage, let it go, draw a line, and say, we can't change the past, but let's agree to walk forward in right relationship with one another. I told you at the outset of this sermon how my dad lost his best friend, his brother. It was miserable when we broke up with Uncle Tom and Aunt Jean's family. Weekends that used to be filled with fun were filled with emptiness. Neither brother was willing to get on the phone and call the other one. Stubborn. Pride. You're the one that's wrong. One day, my mom says, as Dad's moping around the house, "Gordon, call your brother." Dad hesitated for a moment, walked over to the phone, an old wall-mounted phone, and began to slowly dial. This was before caller ID, so Uncle Tom picked up. I will never forget Dad's exact words, the first thing he said. It's etched forever in my mind. He said, "Brother, I owe you an apology." And the ice melted. It was a miracle. Five short words changed everything. My father is pretty irreligious. But even I, at a young age, understood instinctively that what he was doing in this moment was deeply spiritual. He was doing what Jesus tells. He was modeling what the Greek language concept of reconciliation looks like. And they began talking. And within 5 minutes, I hear Dad saying, "Why don't you all come out to our house tonight?" And within a couple hours, they pulled into the driveway and piled out of the car. And Dad had his best friend back. And Mom had her best friend back. I had my best friend back. My little sister had her best friend back. We sat around the fire pit. We talked. We laughed. We played flashlight hide and seek. We even played a little pickup basketball, except we never again let Dad guard Tommy. Never. But the breach was healed. Not because Dad and Tom could figure out who did what right and wrong, but because they realized, what are we doing to ourselves, to our families? This is destructive. Let's draw a line. Let's move forward. What if they hadn't reconciled? We would have lost so many beautiful moments in our life together. Then, of course, there were those city slickers who moved into our neighborhood, who knocked down trees on people's houses and squeezed their big house into our space and put their driveway right on our property line. When they would be out in their backyard, we would not look at them, we would not acknowledge them, and vice versa. They deserved it. When Ed would try to back his olds out of the garage, us kids would watch from the window and laugh. They were our enemies. One night we were out sitting around the fire pit because we were country folk. We spent a lot of time around the fire pit. And Ed walks out his back door. Oops. Tension. We pretend he's not there. He pretends we're not there. It's kind of awkward because they're right there. And all of a sudden, Dad pipes up and says something. He's always got to say something. And I'm thinking, oh, what's he going to say? Dad calls out and says, "Hey, neighbor, why don't you get your wife and come over and have a beer?" What? I'm dumbfounded. Dad, they're our enemy. What do you mean? Ed, you should have seen him. What? He stops for a long second, and Ed says, "Okay, I'll be right back." A few minutes later, here come Ed and Pam and their two little girls. We sit down in the lawn chairs around the fire pit. We start talking. We start hearing where they grew up and what their life is like and where they work and vice versa, and tell us about their daughters and so on and so forth. And a few beers later, Dad and Ed, not the rest of us, a few beers later, a conversation later, the city slicker Nelsons were destroyed. They didn't exist anymore. And in their place were these new people, the beautiful neighborly Nelsons. I mean, it was like a miracle of transformation. Abraham Lincoln said, "Do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friend?" That's the miracle my dad worked that night. He said, "I'll show you. I'll destroy who I think you are and turn you in to beautiful neighbors." through the power of reconciliation. And though my dad was irreligious, it was to me a miracle. He was modeling for me the Jesus concept of what reconciliation looks like. Who is God laying on your heart as we talk about this today? Who have you, figuratively speaking, stuffed into that clear plastic trash bag, and you are carrying that junk, moldy, slimy, smelly, heavy, anger and bitterness with you everywhere you go? It is not good for you. It's worse for you than listening to Barry Manilow music. I'm just preaching it now. It is worse for you than watching an entire marathon of Gilligan's Island reruns. It is worse for you than being doomed to spend your whole life cheering for the Indianapolis Colts. There, I said it. I just said it, all right? Let it go. Not the Colts part. Go ahead. Go ahead. If you're a masochist, keep cheering for them. But nothing like alienating your audience when you're trying to bring it home, right? The anger part. Let it go. It's not, who wants to live that way? Get yourself out of Gehenna. Dare to practice what Jesus preached and start seeing some genuine miracles of reconciliation. That is how we keep our sanity in a mad, mad world full of human conflict. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Like Jesus, our brother, we have the power to work miracles of reconciliation if we dare.